I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels, the founder of Maisels Films, a documentary film company. Albert has been a pioneer in the documentary film world since the 1960s. He's one of the creators, along with his brother David, of a modern documentary genre known as direct cinema. Albert, I'd love to know what year you were born.
1926. I just celebrated my 80th birthday, believe it or not, but there it is.
Do you feel 80?
Not at all. Not at all.
Where did you grow up?
Boston.
How did your parents meet? Were they Bostonians to begin with?
Oh, they met very romantically in Boston, of course. At noontime, they would meet at a street, particular street corner every day and have lunch. What my mother didn't know was that my father would arrive 5 or 10 minutes early, place himself across the street behind a window and just look at her.
Oh. Oh, wow. What did your parents do for a living?
Well, my mother was a school teacher. In those days, in the 30s and even in the 40s, teaching in Boston was, for a woman, was restricted only to women who weren't married. And so they were all spinsters. And so my mother was married, so she couldn't teach in Boston. So we moved to Brookline, and there she found she couldn't teach because she was Jewish, and there weren't any Jewish teachers. So she had to convince the superintendent of schools that she be a teacher, and he allowed her to be what's called a permanent substitute.
So she had some moxie.
Yes. Oh, and she was very devoted to civil rights. Her one dream was to spend some time with Mrs. Roosevelt, and she did. Spent a whole day with her. Many, many years later, when I came back from my first trip to Russia, where I made a film in mental hospitals, I read in the paper that she was going to Russia. This was 1956. She was going to look into social services. She wanted to visit mental hospitals, but she had heard that there weren't any. So I called her up and told her that indeed there were. In fact, I made this film. Oh, come on over and bring your projector. So I spent a whole day, as my mother did, I spent a whole day with Mrs. Roosevelt.
And what did your dad do?
My father was a postal clerk. He should have been a musician. In fact, I have the cornet that he played. Sits in front of me on the wall when I have breakfast every morning. He never played the cornet in my lifetime, because he used to play with his brothers. He had a brother who played the violin, another one percussion, and the third one played another instrument. He died before I was born. And when he died, my father just lost the heart to play and never played anymore. But one day, I happened to bring my cornet into the office, and Wynton Marsalis was in my office to look at a film we had just put together. Of him. And as he was leaving, I thought, oh, I'd tell him the story of the cornet. I brought it to him. Right away, he started playing it. That's the only time I've heard that the cornet played by Wynton Marsalis instead of my father.
Did you feel that, did you get a sense that your father wasn't satiated with his profession as a postal clerk, or did he completely embrace it?
Well, he tried to make the best of it, and in fact, there were so few jobs during the Depression that we were lucky that we had a salaried job. And he always looked forward to the pension, which he would get after 30 years of service. He died 29 years into his service, so we never got the pension.
So what does the son of a postal clerk and teacher decide to do for a living? What was your psychology after you graduated college of what you wanted to do with your life?
Somehow, I wanted to do something great, something along the lines of Charles Darwin, Sigmund Freud, Pasteur, you know, one of those people, Beethoven perhaps, you know. So with that kind of dream, when I was 10 years old, I happened to pick up a book of Freud, Sigmund Freud, and I didn't understand very much of it except that I understood that it was possible to really understand human behavior. And that seemed to me to be a very, very profound and suitable task. And I became a psychologist. In fact, I worked in a mental hospital, headed up a research project at the Massachusetts General Hospital and taught for 3 years at Boston University, all by the time I was 28. And then my adventures began.
And your first adventure was to Russia in 1955. What did you do in Russia, and why did it involve a camera?
Well, I had this passion, which has remained a very strong part of my interest, even now, a passion to portray ordinary people just as they are. We've always lacked that, and we lack that today. I don't know of any images that I've seen of Iraqis, just ordinary people. And so I got a tourist visa to go to Russia, a 30-day visa. Then I thought, okay, I'll bring my camera and get images of ordinary people. And since I knew so much about mental health, I would try to get into mental hospitals. A crazy idea because, you know, 1955, Soviet Union going to let an American into mental hospitals.
They're both in.
You'd have to be crazy to get into one. You know? I remember when I hitchhiked to New York to try to get funds from Life magazine or CBS. I traveled with an old friend of ours, and all I could afford was a very cheap hotel. And the two of us, as he was trying to sleep, I would wake up every hour or so, and I'd turn to Red, and I'd say, "What, do you think I'm crazy? I don't have any permission, and I'm going with a camera that I'm borrowing from CBS." And he, every hour he'd say, "Oh, don't worry, it's okay. You'll be okay." Finally, 4 o'clock in the morning, again, I wake him up, and he turns to me and says, "Al, you know, you're going on a lark." And it must have been at that moment that I must have smiled, because going on a lark is exactly what I do. It's a chancy thing, but I'm flying high.
And this is how you achieve greatness.
I think so.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maysles, a documentary filmmaker. He is one of the pioneers of direct cinema. Direct cinema is a way of capturing reality on camera as life unfolds without scripts or narrations or fancy film sets. Was there anything different about being in a Russian mental hospital than in a mental hospital that spoke English? Was there anything instrumental about that language barrier that was particularly striking to you in any way? Or,
well, I try to get beyond the language barrier. And, of course, I was accompanied by the chief of psychiatry, so I wasn't being shown everything. But one thing that was quite different was that just about all the doctors were women. It sort of had a women's approach, which in some ways got beyond the politics. I had understood, and I know for sure, that there were many political prisoners who were sent to mental hospitals. I was not introduced to them, but I did get a closeness with people, and with my camera I was able to convey that. I brought back the material. I had a deal with CBS, where they would give me all the material eventually, and whatever they would use, they would pay me $1 a foot. So I made $14.
What was the state of technology at the time in the 1950s, 1960s, in terms of, you know, perhaps the sync between the audio and the picture? What did your camera look like?
Well, in 1955, the camera that I took with me was just a simple wind-up camera with reels of film that only ran for 3 minutes, and a noisy camera at that, but no sync sound, which surprised me a great deal. Nothing advanced to the point where you could really do a story spontaneously. You had to use a narrator to explain the stuff that you got on film. All that changed in 1960 when I met up with three other filmmakers, Bob Drew, Richard Leacock, and Don Pennybaker, and the four of us made a film that started a whole revolution in documentary filmmaking. The film was called Primary, and it was of the election campaign between Kennedy and Humphrey. We got behind the scenes and filmed exactly what their experience was.
So in a way, technology enabled you to be a direct cinema filmmaker.
Exactly. Well, once I met up with these guys, we all were mutually inspired and realized that we're into brand new territory that could change the world.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Al Maisels, the documentarian, and the New York Times in 2002 acknowledged Al as the dean of documentary filmmaking. You also were considered a pioneer in the fact that you made the first nonfiction feature film. How would you describe what a nonfiction feature film is?
Well, there's always been feature films that were fiction. Dramatic films that ran at least an hour and a half or so and were really made for the cinema. But documentary, maybe feature length, that is an hour long, but not really features. The big change came especially with Salesman, a film that we made in 1968. We made it with the expectation that it would get shown in movie theaters. When we finished it, none of the cinematic chains were interested in the film. They weren't as revolutionary as we were in our making in the film. But we figured out that we could start the ball rolling by renting a movie theater and showing it. So we showed the film to some 100 or so people at a screening right here in New York to raise money. And as people filed out, they once they'd seen the film, they congratulated my brother and me and Charlotte Zwerin, who edited it masterfully. And I noticed through a crack in the door that there was one person left in the theater. And as she got up to leave, she turned in our direction. I saw she'd been crying. Further, as she got closer, I saw how attractive she was. And I gave my brother the elbow and I said, "She's for me." That's how I met my wife.
Oh, what is your wife's name?
Her name is Jillian. Yeah, the best thing that ever happened to me. In a funny way, it's the best thing that ever happened to the main character of the film, Paul, who's a tragic figure in that he's the most unsuccessful of the four salesmen. But he's unsuccessful because he has that much more poetry in his makeup, that much more humanity. He saw the film with us opening night, and sitting next to me, he cried at the right time. He laughed at the right time. It was his opportunity to be recognized for what he is.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels, one of the creators of the nonfiction feature film. We'll hear more from Albert coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maisels, the founder of Maisels Films, a documentary film company. He was one of the creators, along with his brother David, of the modern documentary genre known as direct cinema. And direct cinema is a way of capturing reality as life unfolds on camera without the use of narration or scripts or film sets. Why don't we play some of Salesman? This is going to be the opening of the film, the first few minutes of the film.
The bestseller in the world is the Bible, for one reason. It's the greatest piece of literature of all time. It's really tremendous, isn't it?
There's the shepherds and the three kings, flight into Egypt, the childhood of Jesus. Mary turns to Aaron, Mary finds Jesus in the temple.
Well, you can see how this would be an inspiration. In the home. You like that, honey? What's her name?
Christine.
Well, she's as bright. She's pretty like a mother, huh? Christine, you know what my name is?
Yes.
Paul. Paul, you know?
Paul? You have a cousin named Paul, don't you, Chris?
You can see how complete it is.
The Bible runs as little as $49.95, and we have three plans on it. Cash, COD, and also they have a little Catholic honor plan.
Which plan would be the best for you, the A, B, or C?
I'm really not interested unless I speak it over my
husband. Yeah. You wouldn't want to give him a surprise. Does he have a birthday coming up? Your lovely gift.
That's true.
We place a tremendous... The Bible is still the bestseller in the world, so...
I just couldn't afford it now, even small with medical bills.
interesting, you know, the little girl goes over to the piano and plays a little tune totally spontaneously, something she'd made up at the moment, I would suppose, right? Every time I see that and hear that music, I think, oh my goodness, Beethoven couldn't have done any better. It was so appropriate to that moment. Mm-hmm. Now, documentaries up to that time, and even now, you know, they depend on a musical score by a composer. But this was an inherent part of it. This little child on her own expressed so beautifully what's going on in Paul's mind without even thinking of it that way.
In a way, spontaneity worked so well for you, you know, in this moment. And that happens to be the case often for you in your films, is you rely so much on spontaneity. Does it ever disappoint? Is there ever a time when nothing happens? Or how often does nothing happen when you want it to?
You just have to wait it out. It'll happen. Spontaneity for me is it has to happen on its own for it to be true. And so when we make a film, we exercise no controls over people, what's going on. That would distort the nature of what's happening. It's chancy. I like to say that we take a chance when we have a child. Who knows what's going to happen?
Another example of sort of spontaneity in your films is a film that you've been working on for decades called In Transit.
Yes.
At first, I think it was called Fellow Passengers and then Train Stories, and now it's called In Transit. What's that about?
I might even change the title to Going on a Lark, because that's what it is. I get on long-distance trains in half a dozen countries of completely different cultures all around the world. And by chance, I expect that as I walk through each one of these trains, a 2 or 3 day trip for each train, I'll find somebody where there's a story about to take place when they get off the train. And I see somebody that looks a little bit nervous. Something seems to be going on, and I'll chat with them and be filming even at that time. People, as I have discovered, would like to express themselves filmically if they can trust the person behind the camera. And somehow people trust me when they see me, and how I look at them, they look back at me in a trusting fashion. I know it's okay.
Why do you think that is, Albert?
I think because I really like people. And even if it's somebody that I might not particularly care for initially, I'll discover things that I like about them. And I also would like to have this heartfelt feeling that it's very important that people be represented for who they are. And sometimes something a little bit embarrassing. But when that person sees it later on, they say, yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's right. It's true.
There's one scene that I've heard of a woman you've met on the train in Pennsylvania. Could you tell that story?
The train is just leaving the Pittsburgh station, and I walk through the train. I see a woman. It looks kind of nervous. Something's going on. She's sitting at an empty table in the cafeteria coach. Sitting across from her is her little child. There I am with it. At that time, a big camera on my shoulder and a sound person next to me. And I ask her if I might join her and maybe do some filming, making a film of people I meet on trains. She said, oh, please. So I began filming. And right away, she told me why she was on the train. When she was 3.5 years old, her parents broke up in an ugly divorce. And her father getting custodianship over her and vowing that her mother would never see her again. She's never seen her mother since she was 3. The night before she got on the train, she got a call from a woman in Philadelphia saying, get on the next train. I'll be waiting for you in the train station. And so when she got off the train, I kept filming. As she began climbing the stairs, a woman at the top of the stairs flung open her arms, rushed down the stairs. And there I filmed the whole encounter, ending with her mother turning to me and saying, isn't she gorgeous?
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Albert Maysles, a documentary filmmaker. He is one of the pioneers of direct cinema. Direct cinema is a way of capturing reality on camera as life unfolds without scripts or narrations or fancy film sets. And your brother, David, was an integral part of your life professionally, and he passed away in what year?
1987.
How did he die?
He had a mild heart attack and got so depressed that he took some sort of medication with the warning that he shouldn't take Alka-Seltzer or, I think, red wine or something like that. And he mistakenly took one of those things, and that was the end.
And how did that affect your work? Because he obviously was working with you very closely.
Well, there was a young woman, Susan Fromke, who had been working with us for many years, and she took over David's role beautifully, and we continued to make films. We made a wonderful film, which she helped in the editing process, a film called Grey Gardens, showing in various forms today. There's a Broadway musical based on it.
What is Grey Gardens about?
It's about two women, the mother, 80 or so, and the daughter, 60. They're Bouviers, so they're from American aristocracy. But for 20 years, they'd been living alone in this decaying old mansion in the Hamptons. Born of American aristocracy, they couldn't quite live the way they wanted to. The mother wanted to be a singer, the daughter a dancer. And so they chose this life as recluses. They lived with so many cats and raccoons, and the whole house was kind of falling apart at that time.
Were they at all averse to providing you access to their lives at all?
Nothing better could have happened to them. They relished the whole idea of just being themselves. Eccentrics that they were, they were extremely entertaining, just filming them with their conversations with themselves. Really, it was a love affair, really, between mother and daughter. So intense that the daughter could never leave the house. And so it was good and not so good for both of them, but mostly good.
Have you ever had this sort of visceral desire to get involved in the lives of any people that you film because you think they're going down a wrong path? Or
I see. Well, my engagement is my disengagement. That is, I don't interfere in any way with what's going on, but I'm engaged in recognizing them and in capturing them exactly as they are. When the mother in Grey Gardens, when she was dying, her daughter turned to her, as she told me, at that moment she turned to her and said, "Is there something more that you want to say?" And her mother responded, "There's nothing more to say. It's all in the film."
You are now a father of how many children?
4 children.
How did they come to understand what their father did for a living?
Oh, well, without any purpose in mind except to entertain my kids, when they were old enough to understand a story, I would tell them stories from my own childhood. For example, I remember telling them how in the 1930s, it was the custom for the father of the family to take the strap to the child when the child misbehaved. And my father had a strap, but he would never use a strap on me. Except that once I must have done something terribly bad. I don't remember what it was. And he took the strap to me. And I think he struck me only once. It didn't even hurt. I didn't think anything of it. Until a few moments later, I happened to walk through the apartment. When I came into his bedroom and crossed to the other side and turned back, and there was my father with the head against the wall crying. I stood there in total amazement, taking in this extraordinary feeling of his love for me. And all those years that went on after that could have told me how much he loved me. It wouldn't have been quite as strong, had a strong effect as that moment.
Are there ever times when you feel frustrated because you wish you had captured a piece of reality on camera and you missed it?
Oh, yes. There have been times now when I certainly should carry a camera with me all the time.
What's an example
of... I was on a bus not so long ago And across from me was a very much overweight black woman. And as she sat there just looking off into space, nothing was happening, but I felt some kind of anticipation of something might take place. So I nudged the woman next to me. Now the two of us, in a very kindly fashion, were looking at her. At that moment, the little girl next to her, maybe 7 or 8, got up, slipped around in front of her mother, and nestled her head between her mother's enormous breasts and fell asleep. From nothing, it just turned into a beautiful act of mother-child relationship, and should have been filming.
You have made over 3 dozen films, and we talked a little bit about, you know, whether it's Primary or Salesman or Grey Gardens, and I could go on. You've had access to Truman Capote and Marlon Brando and the Christos, who wrapped Central Park in these orange flags. How have you gotten access to these people, or how did you get access to these people very early on, like the Rolling Stones, for instance, in 1970?
It's all by happenstance, and it's different in each case. In 1964, I remember sitting at my desk answering the phone. It was the Granada Television from England calling, saying that the Beatles are arriving in 2 hours in New York. Would you like to make a film of them? I put my hand over the phone and turned to my brother and said, "Who are the Beatles? Are they any good?" My brother fortunately knew, and with a big smile on his face, he got on the phone. And we made a deal right away, rushed out to the airport just as the plane was coming down. 6 days later, we had the best film of the Beatles. Filmed as we had learned to make it, you know, totally spontaneous. You really felt, perhaps, that you were the fifth Beatle.
Going back to this access, you've had access to the Dalai Lama. What is a moment from that experience that you remember?
This was just a couple of years ago when the Dalai Lama came to New York to address many thousands of people in Central Park. When you ask for a gray moment, that took place in a hotel where the Dalai Lama was staying. 5 o'clock in the morning, I was with him filming his meditation. It's one of the most powerful, memorable experiences for me as a person and for anybody who will see it. I've met people like that, Reverend Desmond Tutu, for example. He is of that ilk. And they must be represented in documentary. But then I would go all the way in the other direction, too. It's so important that we get to know ordinary people. I'm reminded of an experience that I had when my daughter, who is now 30, when she was 4 years old, there were times in the evening, maybe 10 o'clock in the evening, the two of us would go off down the street to the newsstand to pick up the New York Times for the next day. And so one day, one evening, we went to the newsstand and the paper hadn't arrived yet. And I was getting a little bit nervous. And she turned to me and said, "Daddy, the paper's not finished yet because the people haven't been killed yet." And that has inspired me to film other kinds of events other than violence and killing and so forth, and try to find, as the Dalai Lama does, to find routes to happiness.
You're considered one of the pioneers of direct cinema, where everything happens ad hoc and you're kind of just watching things unfold naturally without your having any agency.
That's right.
But was there a time before you got to that process where you were doing the traditional interviews?
Yes. Between 1955 and 1960, before we had the equipment and the philosophy, we would film in more traditional fashion.
What's an example of that?
Well, when we were in Poland at the time of the revolution there, 1956-57, we would attend a protest, for example, and interview some of the students who were protesting. They were protesting against the banning of their newspaper by the government. And in fact, I remember during the protest, the police didn't know who I was. They thought I was a protester, and they hit me on the head. I got badly bruised below one of my eyes. But right away, I told them in the broken Polish that I was American, and they stopped. And that evening, I met up with a Polish friend that I had recently met. And he said, "You know, Maisels, you and your brother, you know so much better than so many other Americans coming here what's going on here in Poland. You can appreciate it. But now, having been hit on the head, now you know exactly what it's like.
Was there any film that was a turning point for you financially at all? Let's talk about that issue.
Actually, when I think of perhaps the three most outstanding films that we've made, Gimme Shelter, Salesman, and Grey Gardens, Salesman certainly haven't made their money back yet. For one thing, it took over 30 years for Salesman to get on television at all, and 25 years for Grey Gardens. Gimme Shelter, we probably have begun to make a profit. It's a tough profession.
You've just moved to Harlem from where? Where were you living before you were in Harlem?
In the Dakota building where John Lennon lived.
How does a documentarian live in the Dakota?
You marry the right person.
I just want it to be on the record that in your clothes, you have a name tag on every single garment. Why do you have name tags on all of your clothes, even into your 80s?
When I was a child, I had the dream of going to summer camp, like all the other kids, but we could never afford that. And what I liked about it so much was you had to have a name tag on all your clothes when you go to summer camp. So all my clothes have name tags. I sew them on myself, whether it's my shirt or my underpants or my jacket, whatever it is, or coat.
Thank you very much for joining us, Albert.
It's expired. That was an hour? That was fast. Yeah, good.
My guest has been Albert Maysles, the famed documentary filmmaker. If you're interested in any of his films or to learn more about Albert, you could go to his website at maislesfilms.com.
That's it.
You don't need the www. Coming up, we'll meet Bikram Chowdhury, founder of Bikram Yoga. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bikram Chowdhury, founder of Bikram Yoga. Bikram Yoga is a series of 26 traditional yoga poses practiced in a hot room about 105 degrees. Bikram started practicing yoga in Calcutta, India, when he was 3 years old. And when he was 11, Bikram became the youngest contestant to win the National India Yoga Competition 3 years in a row. There are now more than 2,000 Bikram studios worldwide, including Mexico, Singapore, Korea, Chile, and Australia. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
Please talk to me about your first exposure to yoga at 3 years old. How does a three-year-old become exposed to yoga?
Well, when British left India, 1947, it was like a Hiroshima disaster. No food, no civilization, kind of. And the diseases, people are dying, millions everywhere, in cholera, typhoid, pox.
Smallpox.
So in my family, almost everybody has smallpox. So in 48 hours, my older sister and my younger brother died. And my oldest brother, George, my older sister had. So after two deaths, my mother was kind of shocked. So she didn't know who else is going to die. So my dad thought the best thing will be to move the whole family to Devghar for health.
After your siblings died of smallpox and your mother was kind of shaken up by the experience.
Exactly.
You needed to find some respite and solace in Devghar.
That's it. So they put everybody covered with the blanket in the train because almost everybody has some kind of disease going out of city. So after 2 months, my brother, sister got better. They used to go to study Hindi language to the master. So he used to teach Hindi language to Bengali children.
Because you didn't speak Hindi at the time.
So I used to go there, sit in the guru's lap for 2 or 3 hours quietly. So he used to hold my feet and hang me upside down called headstand. He used to hold me my whole hands and feet and hang me. It's called bow posture.
This guru who was teaching your brothers Hindi actually taught you yoga.
Yoga. I didn't know it's a yoga.
You didn't know it was called yoga, but he was teaching you those poses just in a playful manner.
Yes, that's it.
And then you moved to Calcutta and you continued with this yoga.
Exactly.
Okay.
I was 5 and there's a playground. So I used to go play with the children. And somehow I crossed the alley. I see all the big bodybuilder, big muscle, huge gymnasium. And I saw all the kids doing same thing what the masters taught me. So I said, wait a minute, I can do those things much better than you doing it. There's a man who was sitting. He said, hey, you, come here. What's your name? I said, Bikram. Wow, show me more. Now I realize his eyes get big. How can a 5 years old boy can do all these things? He said, wow, come every day here. I will teach you more.
When you were a child, in addition to having this love towards yoga, you also had a fascination with cars. Where does your fascination with fancy cars stem from?
I don't know how it started, but I used to stand on the main road. Maybe after 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes, one car used to pass. And I used to say, Hillman, Ford, Plymouth, Dodge, DeSoto, Packard, Cadillac. Before history, I remember the name of the car.
So your fascination with cars continues today.
All my life.
And you have Bentleys and Rolls
yesterday,
Royces.
Yesterday, I bought six cars.
Six cars you bought yesterday?
Yesterday.
What kind of cars?
Four Bentleys, two Rolls.
Now, you've often made a parallel link between the human body and a
automobile,
car and
yes.
an automobile.
My guru did same thing.
Explain that.
Well, when you didn't start the car for 3 months, you went to Europe, you came back home. In New York, so cold, car doesn't start. So what do you do? Throw the car in the junkyard and buy another car? No. You recharge the battery and the car is fine. So same thing about the human body. Modern medical treatment is something wrong, you get rid of it. You know, you have a little back pain, you operate it. You take the vertebrae out, the disc out. We don't do that. In yoga, you preserve it. You fixed it. You don't get rid of it. So your husband is not good, man. That doesn't mean you divorce him and find another husband. So you fixed him by disciplining him, teaching him. That's called India, Indian culture. So that's come from yoga.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bikram Chowdhury, the yoga guru who developed and now copyrighted a series of 26 postures practiced in a hot room. There are over 2,000 Bikram yoga studios worldwide. Traditional Hatha yoga, which is the type of yoga that you teach, has 84 postures. And you've broken it down into 26 postures. How come?
You can take care of your whole body if you do 84 postures. So I have done all my life. But I picked up 26 postures to make a package for simple, easy people to maintain good health.
Why a hot room for this yoga? I understand that Indian heat is, you know, that India is maybe above 100 degrees. So were you trying to mimic Indian heat in a closed room?
Two reasons. You are right. I mimic Indian heat temperature. And the second reason is that when I taught yoga in India, teaching American body, European body, first day they are minus 10,000 physically. I never knew human body could be so bad if they are coming from America or in Europe. Big body and bad body. So they cannot stretch. In the cold room, when they're trying to do the posture, instead of improvement, they get more hurt. So I have to keep the window closed so not to fresh air comes.
Even before Western medicine was developed, India turned towards yoga and turned towards Ayurvedic remedies in order to cure the body.
Yes.
Instead of treating each patient or each person individually, oh, this person has a back problem, you do this posture, this person has arthritis, you do that posture, you develop these 26 postures in a certain series that would take care of the whole kit and caboodle.
I'm the first man in the history of my country created something that a group of people, each one has different kind of medical disease, disorder, remedy, but a group of people can do together. So it doesn't matter what kind of medical problem you have. Now, you came to my class to fix your bad knee only. You had a car accident, operated 3 times, till you are limping. I'm not going to treat your knee. I don't want to know even your name. I don't want to know even what problem you have. I'll start from your lungs, then the heart, then completely digestive system, you know, pancreas, kidneys, to spleen, liver, intestine, colon, uterus, ovaries, everything I'll take care. Then I'll go to your spinal system. Then I go to nervous system. Then I go to brain cells. But end of the day, I'll fix your knee also.
Now, speaking of knees, you were a weightlifter in India.
Yes, Olympic weightlifter.
As well as a yogi. But all of that weightlifting was put to a halt when somebody dropped a weight on your knee.
My knee.
And your kneecap.
Over 400 pounds.
And your kneecap crumbled?
Not kneecap. The whole leg with the knee was crass, dust. So they want to amputate my leg. I went to every doctor around the globe. And I was not even 18. I was ready to go to Tokyo Olympic to get a gold medal. I want to kill myself.
So how was your knee cured?
6 months yoga every day. 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours a day. I should not say I was cured, but I should say I was okay to have a normal life.
In addition to your knee getting healed, you decided then to share this wealth of yoga to students around
with
the world.
My life. Tell me, how many people in this earth been told like me, sorry, nothing we can do anymore? After 5 surgery, 10 surgery, all the medication, all the drugs, go to church. How many people?
Now, how did you start spreading your type of yoga to the United States? One of the first people to benefit from your treatment was President Nixon.
Nixon, yes.
In Hawaii. Tell me that story.
Well, before I taught, a lot of American people, like George Harrison, came to learn from me in 1959. Shirley MacLaine, 1960. So before I came to America in 1970, I taught thousands of, I said a little ago, American people in India, in Japan. Japan, I was a very well-known yoga teacher. All the bases, Tachikawa, Kamsama, Yokosuka, Atsugi, all American bases, all the Vietnam soldier coming injured, I used to treat them, thousands of thousands.
Huh.
So I was very well-known in Japan, all American bases. So that time I cured Prime Minister Tanaka. He has a cerebral thrombosis. He was vegetable. So in 4 months, I make him normal.
This is the Japanese Prime Minister?
Japanese Prime Minister. So he was having a meeting with Nixon in Honolulu. But Nixon, he has phlebitis, thrombosis, left leg suffering for a long time. Blood clot in the leg. We call traffic jam.
Okay.
So he went to Pearl Harbor Navy Hospital for operation. The doctor said, sorry, it's all clot. We cannot touch it. We cannot open it. He was agony in pain. It was Sunday, my yoga school telephoned. I said, no, not now. I pick up Ambassador of America. Bikram, stay downstairs with your passport. I'll pick you in 20 minutes. Hang up. Why, when, nothing. From Atsugi base, he put me big C-130, huge plane, to Honolulu in 7 hours. And the sixth floor sitting in front of President Nixon and his wife. So I put bathtub, hot tub with Epsom salt, gave him yoga hydropathic treatment, therapy.
It's yoga in the bathtub.
Or after that, outside.
Okay.
So I did 6 treatments in 3 days. When you're leaving, we're sitting in the airport. He said, let's go to Washington. I said, no, I got to go to Tokyo. So he gave me an envelope and I gave him a tape. So he should practice those postures, 20 minutes. I said, if you maintain this tape, do yoga every day, you will never remember which leg was the bad one. 24 years he lived. Never had any problem. And the envelope, you know what? That was my green card.
So Nixon gave you his a green card in exchange for your fixing his blood
clot.
And
built 3 schools for me in Honolulu, San Francisco, in Los Angeles, also from Nixon.
You come to the United States, and initially you weren't charging for your classes. You weren't charging people.
The first 2 years, I didn't charge any money. I teach free.
How come?
Because India, going to yoga school means you go to a temple to pray. No charge. Still today.
Why did you change your mind?
I didn't change. Shirley MacLaine.
Shirley MacLaine told you to change.
Yes. He said, welcome to America. Welcome to Hollywood. When you're in Rome, you must do what Roman does.
Mm.
If you don't charge, people don't think you really know what you're doing.
Mm.
Then you never draw a respect from people when you don't charge.
Were classes popular? How did the word get out about Bikram Yoga?
Mostly lecture and demonstration. Every weekend, I used to give lecture demonstration, school, college, university, everywhere.
Were there a few people who really changed the popularity of Bikram to some extent?
Not until Shirley MacLaine built the school in Beverly Hills. Once she opened the Beverly Hills school, first show, she put me in Johnny Carson show. Next one, Marv Griffin, Mike Douglas, Dinosaur show. And also, only by invitation, only movie star can come.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bikram Chowdhury, the yoga guru who developed and copyrighted a series of 26 postures practiced in a hot room. Bikram is known as yoga's bad boy because of his outspoken remarks and unconventional approach to yoga. Bikram's students have included tennis player John McEnroe, LA Lakers basketball player Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, former Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, and Shirley MacLaine. You call your class a torture chamber. And what you often say to your students is, would you prefer 90 minutes of suffering or 90 years of suffering?
That's it.
How come this approach, rather than being a little more gentle on your students?
Again, America taught me, no pain, no gain. No suffering, no pleasure. Jessica, this is the reality, truth of human life. Let's face the truth. Nothing is easy in human life. To gain something, you have to invest something.
Now, you claim that there are no harmful side effects of this yoga. Are there
any? Not me. It's my country. He's been practicing Hatha Yoga under a right guru thousands of years ago. I never hurt anybody in my life. Anybody harm from you?
How about people fainting in the hot class? Have they?
It's a 30 seconds faint. That's the introduction of self-realization. You conquered the fear of your life when you fainted.
Now I understand you didn't charge for classes when you initially had your studio, but you've kind of seemed to have gone to the other extreme by copywriting your 26 poses a few years ago.
Right.
Why that shift to copyright your series?
Because lots of people was teaching my yoga, learning from some other school, and a lot of complaint was coming, people getting injuries. So I was getting complaint from all over the country. My student, Anna, she was a personal assistant to Janet Reno. And Janet Reno was the attorney general. So I asked her, what can I do to tell people policing? She said, you have to copyright, trademark, franchising your yoga so nobody can steal it. That was Department of Justice Department's idea to me.
Now, many people were up in arms about that, including, you know, the Indian government, who says that, you know, yoga has been around for 5,000 years. How can you make it proprietary? How can you kind of commercialize it in this proprietary way?
Sure.
And what is your reaction to them?
Nothing. I just educate them. They're ignorant. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. I'm in America. America taught me how to live American way. So that's why I did it, you know.
And so it's that series of 26.
Yes, 26
it's not
postures.
The actual poses.
Yes. So English language cannot be copyright public domain, but the book could be. Doreen Mipa is a public domain. But Quincy Jones, when created a melody and put a lyrics, it's become a song, Billie Jean, it's copyright. You cannot do it.
I understand. So there are over 2,000 yoga studios, Bikram yoga studios around the world.
Yes.
And you have not franchised them or charged a franchise fee at all. When a teacher takes training at your studio, they then have the ability to go off and start their own studio, Bikram yoga studio.
Yes.
But you don't charge them for this franchise.
No, I never charge them.
What you do charge them for is the 2 months of teacher training, which is about $10,500.
Including accommodation.
Have you thought about charging a franchise fee?
Yes, because recently, to protect those 2,000 schools is a huge lawyer bills.
This might sound Pollyanna-ish, but I think that a lot of the strife and problems in the world is due to pent-up energy and people not liking themselves.
Yes.
How would you respond to that? Do you think if we put Bikram yoga studios in the Middle East, for example, that people would be
anywhere
more peaceful?
In the world. Middle East, I have school also. I have a most successful school in Kuwait and in Dubai. And from Pentagon selected me as a Peace Corps leader to go all Islamic country from America to Pakistan and teach them self-realization, to fall in love with themselves instead of, you know, spitting in the sky and coming back to your own face. I don't know anybody in the world who love himself like me. When you take care of yourself, then you can create same relation with somebody else.
How often do you practice Bikram yoga?
3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, advanced class. I do 84 postures.
How are your eating habits?
I eat very little, once a day. Late night, like at 10:30, 11, 12 o'clock, this much like a baby. But only 4 things I eat out of 4, 1, either meat or fish or egg or chicken.
And how about tea or coffee or alcohol?
I never drink tea, coffee in my life, one drop in my life. I never had touched one drop of beer or champagne or any liquors in my life, never touched cigarette. You will never meet another cleanest living human being in the earth in 20th century or 21st century like me, I guarantee you.
And you also claim that your yoga keeps people looking young. Why is that?
Are you kidding?
Why
is that? It's simple. Keep the body full of vitality. You have excess of energy. You eat less and you sleep less. And you have the same body. Never get sick. Everything under control. You are bulletproof, waterproof, windproof, fireproof, emotion-proof, stress-proof, strength-proof, sex-proof, emotion-proof. Even at old age, yogi never become old.
Look at you.
Look at me.
How old are you?
62 running.
Wow, you look 42.
For me, it's getting harder and harder and harder because I missed a lot of classes. 8 months, I'm in the air. I traveled so much.
Why are you traveling so much?
Oh, my God. Because yoga is so big around the world. Everybody trying to buy my name around the globe, open the school. I don't like this kind of life too much. I have to support all these teachers, all the schools. I take care of millions and millions of people around the globe. But they trust me.
But don't lose sight of what created all of this.
I know.
Well, namaste.
Namaste. And thank you so much for inviting me.
My guest has been Bikram Chowdhury, the founder of Bikram Yoga. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.